Hi, my name is Gunnar Froh and I'm your host on the Wunder Mobility podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Wunder Mobility podcast. Today I'm with Johan from OX Drive. Welcome, Johan.
Hey, Gunnar. Good to see you again.
Johan, you have a very exciting car sharing company, but you also have a background as an entrepreneur that's interesting. You're based in Latvia and you have all electric cars, exciting cars in your fleet. You have grown over the last 2 years and you have very interesting operations metrics to show for. You had some sleepless nights and you basically showed that premium in car sharing can pay out, can be a thing. Tell us a bit about your background as a person, as an entrepreneur, before we drive into OX Drive.
Okay, sure. I started, I've never had a normal job or an actual job. Right out of the university, I went to the military service and then I went into building tech startups just because I thought it's cool. It seemed like everybody on TechCrunch is raising millions. So I thought like, hey, let's raise some millions and build some companies. So yeah, tried to build one company. It didn't go super well. It was a website builder tool using like chatbots, because chatbots were a hot topic back in 2016. 5-6 years too early to the market, because now ChatGPT is doing super well. So I did that, actually managed to sell the company, not for a lot of money. But we did that. Then me and my co-founder from that company went on to build another chatbot company. But now we were building a customer support kind of management tool for, let's say, mid-size enterprises. And it got to a relatively decent stage. But at the same time, you know, a couple of years ago, I got really excited about EVs, really excited about Teslas and kind of the future of mobility or electric mobility. And I was spending days and nights kind of, I don't know, reading about Tesla, how they're doing manufacturing, battery technology, kind of all that stuff. And it seemed like so exciting and cool. And like, this is the future. I got super excited about that and thought like, what can I do in this space? And the thing is like, I'm originally from Estonia, but I live in Latvia. And I have also a very good friend of mine who is now my co-founder, Egia, with whom we studied together, and two other guys. That joined us, the co-founders, and we studied together with them as well. And, you know, it was three, four years ago, I'm living in Riga. I see that Latvia is significantly lagging behind in terms of electrification compared to other European countries. The average car is like more than 10 years old. And of course it makes sense because the kind of, let's say, income level of people is relatively lower than, let's say, in Central Europe. So people can't really afford premium cars here. And if you talk about like a new Tesla or EVs, they are quite high priced vehicles. That kind of justifies also that the electrification is kind of lagging behind in this country. And I thought like, is there something that we can do about it? At the same time, car sharing actually in Latvia is very popular. I think the first car sharing company launched here back in like 2016. And now there's like six operators on a market where there's, I think, 600,000 people even living in Riga, something like that. And we have like several thousand car sharing cars now in the market. So I got together with Egia. We had lunch. She had run car sharing before. She launched CityB in Latvia, which is one of the kind of largest operators here in these markets. And we started talking about like car sharing and whether we could do it on Teslas. Turned out she had a similar idea. And we were like, okay, let's do it. Let's try it out. See if we can launch car sharing on Teslas, you know, popularize or like make it easy for people to get access to a cool and shared electric vehicle, kind of to show that like, okay, EVs can be better than ICE vehicles, and at the same time, you don't have to spend a lot to actually drive these cars. Because if you look at, for example, our pricing, we are not priced higher than other kind of, let's say, not like premium segment cars, but they're somewhere between like compact or compact and premium vehicles. So like, I don't know, competitors, I don't know, Audi A4, for example, or VW Passat, something like that. So the price level is roughly the same. It's not actually that much more expensive.
And you went over relatively quickly your entrepreneurial experience that you had before, like right into your current passion about cool electric cars, like I say, and um, Tesla especially, but you've extended into other brands, Audis, Porsches. Let's talk a little bit about the experience in the beginning. You came from the military and you were reading TechCrunch. You see people raising funding rounds and so on. And you launched the first companies. And I was reading about it also, how you had international investors from the beginning. So your first startup went through the Axel Springer's Plug and Play Accelerator in Berlin. You had different agents on board. The second one, you had agents from San Francisco, former Pipedrive co-founders and so on. Through all this experience, several years raising, launching product, iterating, maybe selling, then second one shutting down and so on. How did this benefit you in the launch of car sharing? Because now it's not SaaS products, software and that kind of distribution, but now you have these operations to deal with and the assets to finance and so on. To what extent did that benefit you? How did you, what lessons could you take into launching a car sharing from your previous experience?
I would say two things. One is that like you already know the motions that you need to go through to get something up and running. So I don't know, first time it takes you a year to raise the necessary funding, set up, the legal structure, some operations, tech infrastructure, backend, all that kind of stuff. And then as you do it again and again, you already know like, okay, I need to do this. I need to do this. I'm not going to spend my time on doing something kind of stupid or I already know kind of, this thing is not going to work. So I'm not going to waste my time on that. I'm going to focus on this instead. So kind of just, this experience of going through the motions because, raising money is basically, it's a process that you need to go through. Make a tech, make financials, approach investors, you need to, go through a certain amount of leads, pre-qualify them, et cetera. And maybe I think as an early stage or like first time founder, but the investors oftentimes do, which kind of makes sense, is you talk to them and they never tell you, no immediately or this idea sucks, something like that. They always kind of want to make sure that if this thing does work out, they have a good relationship with you so they can work with you in the future. So as a inexperienced founder, it's relatively easy to get kind of, mistake the information for being validation that you get from them, which is actually not. And, as you kind of get more experience in that, you already kind of, you can look out for the early signals that, okay, I shouldn't waste my time here. I'm going to focus on somebody else. Yep. So stuff like that. And the other part, I think, is when we talk about like car sharing, et cetera, so like the software component, I would say that like, having background in building like software startups for software companies, you can take these learnings and experiences and apply them in car sharing and like use the kind of IT knowledge part. Because also, for example, we have our backend software, but that's not all we have, right? Like we need to also, a lot of the stuff is that we use today is, we need to integrate with the local road administration, which is kind of outside of the white label software that we're using. A bunch of other stuff like, internal kind of tools and software that you can use to automate your kind of processes. So you're not just kind of throwing people at the problem, but you kind of come up with smart automation software. So that background, I think, is very, very helpful.
Cool, perfect.
And naturally, it meant also that I ended up being the guy who had to, build the first website and get it up and running, even though I'm not a developer myself.
And then you launched OX Drive with this passion for EVs and seeing how Latvia had an interest in electric vehicles. And there's a lot of car sharing already happening, but not really access to cool EVs yet. What did your go-to-market strategy look like? How did you find your first customers and what were the priorities during the first 2 years for you?
Yeah. We were never really worried about finding the first customers. We knew that this is going to be popular and get a very good adoption. It was the challenge really for us was in the beginning when we wanted to get started was to get debt financing for the cars because also equity was relatively easy to raise, but debt was super hard because first of all, got four guys with a slide deck coming to a bank and being like, hey, we would like a couple of million to buy some Teslas. the bank was like, here's the door. So we needed to work on that quite hard to find the necessary debt financing to buy cars. And obviously equity investors don't want to give equity money for buying cars. So buying the assets is hard. The other trick, challenging part, of course, was that Tesla is not formally present in the Baltic markets. So we had to like source the cars, but also, there's no buyback guarantees. The lenders in this region in general are not used to not used to financing Teslas, etc. So, and they have no experience also when we talk about like repairing the cars, maintaining them, servicing, all these kind of things. We had to figure out, and that was kind of all kind of the challenging stuff. But then kind of once we launched, like it was quite easy, like it picked off so quickly. Of course, it helps here that my co-founder Egea is very, very, very good when it comes to marketing. We had a crazy launch event where we had some, which we spent very little money on, but basically we had all of the Latvian media and all of the influencers at that event, and everybody was, you know, talking about it. And I think we were like a number one news kind of this story for a week after we launched. So it got like, it was something like 12 or 15,000 users in the first few days. And then it just kind of kept going from there.
You mentioned in the beginning, so your actual key bottlenecks were not finding the first users, but the debt financing to buy the assets and then sourcing the cars. Tesla was not really present. There's no buyback guarantee and so on. And we say debt financing is a challenge because equity is actually relatively easy. Many people might think, okay, wait a minute. Like for us, it's not easy. Why do you think that was? Was that because of your previous startup experience, our previous connections, people trusted you?
You mean the equity financing?
Yeah, the equity financing part. Why was that easy for you? Or do you think it's for everyone?
We were not raising that much in terms of equity. It's like 500K, which is like, it's not, you know, some enormous amount of money to get started, even here in the Baltics. So, of course, it helped that we had a network of investors that we could approach already, you know, angels doing 10, 50K, 75K tickets. So it didn't take a lot to kind of put that round together. We actually had we started raising, and we were raising the money to kind of put the thing together for like 1.5 years. And we had the equity, we wanted to raise like 500K in equity, and we had that money together like 3 times. We would have the money together, but we wouldn't have the debt to buy the cars. So some of the investors that had committed the money were like, I'm going to pull out, you know, I have some other things I want to put my money in. So, wow. and so we went through that like 3 times. And then the third time we kind of everything got together and we actually managed to kind of, you know, pull things off.
Very interesting. Also the equity financing part, at first the numbers are like in reach if you bring several people together. And you mentioned before we started recording that there was, for example, at least one person that they were interested in investing in your earlier startup, but that was already coming to an end. So you brought them with you. So I assume many of them were basically investing in you and your co-founders and not yet necessarily.
Yeah, especially when you talk with about angels. So we have like, you know, I think seven angels on the board. Seven angels is investors, and then one kind of like a non-bank lender. That's like an equity investor and a debt provider. So, you know, the angels, they kind of come in, they believe in the vision, and but they do invest in the founders and the story after all, not really like into your Excel model that you might have.
What gave you the breakthrough on the debt financing part that was difficult for a while? How did you finally solve that?
The breakthrough was basically we came together with a group called Elevink, who is a non-bank vehicle financing entity or company here in the Baltics, and they operate in a bunch of other markets. And they know this space, so they know vehicle financing quite well. And they had also been looking for ways to get into you could say a car sharing or also like sustainable mobility space. So kind of the stars aligned that, you know, we had this idea, we had this background and kind of knowledge to kind of pull this off. And they were like, cool, let's do this.
And it just took a while. It just took a while to find the right people that were also interested in the space. Did you make them interested in this, or were they already and now they found the right people to do it? Because I believe that it's often the case that you can't really change somebody's mind. It's more like you look around until you find the person that already matches what you also think, right?
Yeah, you need to find somebody that believes what you believe. Essentially, so yeah.
And then on sourcing the car. So when you first got started, it's not so long ago, about 2 years only, I think. The Tesla was not...
Yeah, we've been on the market like 1.5 years only. Yeah.
1.5 years. And Tesla...
Even less.
Tesla, you mentioned, was not officially covering the Baltics, and you have some challenges securing the cars, buyback guarantees and so on. How is that today? Is that still something that you are unique in to have this access? Do you see this being an advantage somehow going forward on the procurement of cars or maybe maintenance of cars and so on? Or is that kind of something that's going to erode because now everyone can easily buy Teslas in your region?
So yeah, I mean, like when we were starting, it was also basically the peak of this COVID craziness when, mm-hmm. when car prices were going up every month for a while. We, of course, experienced some of that as well. And we had no unique advantage in terms of buying cars. We couldn't buy new cars because there was no supply. Like the waiting times were like 6-9 months, I think, for new cars. And we were like, we need to launch in 2 months or 3 months. So we literally were just buying cars off of Mobile or wherever we could find them for the best possible prices. Of course, now the situation is very different. Now we have a supply chain in place. We buy cars, you know, way below the, let's say, retail market price that you would be buying the cars for. We work with, you know, bulk sellers and bulk buyers all over the Europe. And we are in a pretty good place. And I think we are now also like, you know, the biggest, apparently we are the biggest Tesla fleet owner outside of Tesla core markets, which we found out like recently from Tesla. We're going to be in a very unique position in the Baltics. So, and we're the biggest Tesla fleet owner. We're actually one of the biggest EV fleet owners in the Baltic markets as well. We've had to because we don't have a choice, because nobody was doing these things here. We had to figure out how to fix the cars, how to maintain them, how to handle any warranty cases, how to even like insurance was a very big challenge for us. Like when we wanted to get started, out of 7 insurance companies that are on the market, only one even agreed to insure us. The others one were just like, not going to happen. Not even like, they didn't even give us a price. They were like, we're just not going to do it.
And we haven't mentioned this here on the yet, so not everyone might know current fleet size approximately, like year and a half later. Can you share some metrics?
Yeah, we're at 151 cars today. We started with 22 back in end of June last year. 2022. And now we're at 150. So we
and that's a bit of a mix, I think. At least that's what I can see like from the outside. I wasn't in your market to try it out. Like, but you have, in addition to Teslas, also Audis and Porsches now in the fleet?
So we had Porsches, we did like a limited campaign in partnership with the local Porsche dealership. So one of the cool things with kind of having this, starting out with Teslas or having this kind of box drive brand is that we have an amazing brand. People love it and people kind of know it. You know, the perception about box drive is maybe like quite different than other car sharings. So also it means that other, let's say, premium brands want to really work with us. One of them was like Porsche. We did a partnership where we put two of their Taycans on into our fleet for the summer period. And we are considering now adding them as a kind of permanent part of our fleet because they did extremely well. And now a few weeks ago, we launched something similar with the Audi dealership here. So we added 5 e-tron SUVs, and we're kind of like seeing how that category does now. But basically it's 5 cars, most of it is still like Teslas, and of course we're planning to add like different other brands as well over time.
That's quite interesting for me because like you have a relatively small fleet size. If we talk to Europe car guys or 6 guys or so, it's super small, and yet when it comes to EVs and Tesla sourcing, reselling, maintenance, and so on, you are already quite unique in your experience. You have, like you mentioned, largest fleet outside of their core markets and so on, and kind of pioneering some experiences. Can you talk a little bit more what you learned in terms of maintenance, repairs, insurance? You mentioned it was hard to get one initially, but you also told me before that you're even self-insuring to a large extent now, but you've really gone through some iterations already on these topics. How far did you get on maintenance, repairs, insurance topics?
The good thing with Teslas is that the maintenance part is like almost non-existent, right? Because what you need to do is like, you know, change the brake calipers from time to time, check some coolant levels, and I don't know, fill up the windshield fluid, basically. It's really, you know, not that hard, and we haven't had any like meaningful issues with the maintenance of the cars. Most of the stuff that you need to kind of spend time on is repairs. So it's either some sort of a collision, accident, you know, fender bender, stuff like that, or something kind of goes wrong with the car, so something doesn't really like work. The thing is that like normally any kind of, you know, if something goes wrong with the car, normally it would be a warranty thing because all of our cars are in the warranty. But the issue for us is that the closest warranty is in Helsinki and the other one is in Warsaw. which are Helsinki is one day of traveling and several hundred euros in delivery cost. And Warsaw is kind of roughly similar. So I don't know, car on a trailer there is a couple of hundred euros. So that means that we always have to calculate if something goes wrong with the car, do we take the car to Tesla warranty or do we do it ourselves? And then we also have to, of course, like price in the opportunity cost because every day that the car is not on the street, it's losing us money. So it ends up being that we do most of the repairs here. So we have by today built out our own repair shop where we have two people working. We source our own parts as well. And this means that we are able to repair our cars, let's say something around 80% below the normal market price. So what is we had a case, right? No, I'm not kidding, actually. So I'll just give you an example. We just finished actually repairing one of the cars that was in a very serious collision last year. Luckily, we've only had a few and to tell you nothing very recently. So that's very good. But that car, the initial repair estimate for that car was, I think it was like 26 or 27,000 euros. So it was basically a write-off. Our actual cost of fixing that car, and it's basically done now, is 5.4 thousand euros. So what we did is we found a donor car for a very good price. So basically on that car, the front was kind of destroyed. But I mean, Teslas are relatively simple. Like there's just parts you need to fix them because a lot of the stuff is like under the car, etc. In the front of the car, there's not that much stuff that, or like not even like that much expensive stuff that needs to be fixed. So we found a donor car for less than 10,000 euros, which was with a good front. We took all of that front, put it on the other car, just paintwork, and just needed to stretch a few things on the frame of the car. And the car is basically as good as new. And then the donor car, we still have like, you know, the battery pack left and a bunch of like other parts that we are using for our other cars as we need them. So it means that, yeah, we got the car back on the street for like 20% of the initial repair estimate cost. And this is similar, like another example I can give you is, let's say normally if you have a fender bender or you're like very common in car sharing is, you know, bumper damages, bumpers, headlights, stuff like that. Normally your repair time in a regular repair shop would probably be something like 2 weeks. So from the moment you bring in the car to until you get the insurance approval, until you order the, you know, bumper, until it comes, until you paint it, it can be like 2 weeks. 2 weeks is probably even minimal. It can take even longer. For us, it's probably less than 12 hours. The turnaround time. So what we have, of course, like we have all the common parts already in the right color waiting in our repair shop. So if something happens to your car, it just comes into the repair shop, bumper comes off, new bumper goes on, car goes back on the street, continues to earn money. And the damaged bumper, like we will, based on how damaged it is, either it goes into repairing separately or it's, you know, we throw it away. And then, of course, we source the parts ourselves as well. So we get them for, you know, way below kind of the market prices.
And while you are saying that, you're like basically smiling the whole time. And that's how I kind of also saw you before. You're super happy that you went into this. It was not just following like your personal passion. You love these EVs, so you want to work with them, but you see them working out well for you in your metrics, in your business case. Why is that not the case for the big rental companies that are now trying to take a step back and Hertz and Sixtar getting rid of their Tesla fleets again? What do you think from the outside that they are missing, or why does it not work out well for them?
It is a little bit hard to comment in a sense that different rental companies or possibly car sharing companies work under different models. It really like depends, you know, on the financing structure, how you bought the cars, whether you got any bulk discounts, etc. And also like, I don't know, how the car is being used. What is your, I think, in Hertz case, it was also issues with repairing of the cars that they were getting damaged and they couldn't like, figure out how to repair them. Of course, the advantage for us, right, is that like, we are still very small. So we can be, like, it's not like we have 20,000 Teslas to fix or maintain. We have 150 and we can be relatively like creative in how we do these things and kind of build up the knowledge over time. If we had, if somebody gave us like 20,000 Teslas today, it might get a little bit tricky to manage that fleet. So that's one thing, I guess, also.
So you're suggesting they went into this too fast, maybe, didn't learn, didn't take the time to learn.
Yeah. And I guess the other issue, of course, was that Teslas have had issues with resale values. in the last few years. But it really also like depends, you know, when you bought the car. If you bought the car like, I don't know, 5 years ago, then your average depreciation probably is not that high. It's 3 to 5%. If you bought the car like 2 years ago, you are looking at, you know, 25% or maybe even more, because Tesla changed the new car values, and then, you know, the secondary market that kind of reacts as well. Another thing, of course, interesting in Europe is, you know, we have all these EV subsidies in different countries that really play into the secondary market price of the cars as well. So, of course, we as well, you know, we're quite a bit hit by that when we, because we bought the cars, like the first 40 cars at the peak of the market. But luckily, you know, now we are buying really the cars like at very, very good prices. So overall, we are kind of more or less break even, I think, on our fleet value right now. So yeah, that's what I guess, yeah.
So different from the big guys. First aspect, they bring so many of them on at once. So can they even learn how to serve them efficiently? And then the second aspect, maybe if you buy like a big bulk at a certain point in time, you might just, your timing might be off. It's like market timing if values go up and down, but you are buying, I guess, continuously more or less.
Yeah. So we've been building our fleet relatively gradually. So the prices have kind of averaged out overall. And yeah, like exactly, because like I think Hertz or Sixt, like they bought these cars like at the very peak of the market, and they bought like a huge volume of them. And yeah, so they are looking at, you know, 20-25% depreciation, just kind of like that, not even taking into account the mileage of the car, etc. So yeah, could be quite tricky.
We talked a lot about the supply side now, basically how you access debt financing, source the cars, optimized your repairs. Let's switch over a bit to the demand side. You already said brand. You have a great brand. You had a successful launch event. One of your co-founders is super good in marketing. She's also from the industry. How are you positioning the cars at the moment? Also price-wise, how do you segment the market of car sharing users? Basically, who are you going after and how are you looking at the demand side?
So in general, you could say that there is no loyalty among car sharing users.
It's the first thing that comes to your mind. Super interesting.
I mean, there is some. There. Of course, like we also have, you know, these like super passionate users who are like actually sending me, for example, pictures. And like, if they can't find our car nearby, they take another car sharing to our car, and they're like sending pictures and pitching about other car sharing. But that's of course an exception to the rule. You know, 90% of the users, what they care about is price and location of the car when they're taking it. And then everything else is kind of like nice to have or extra have. So I don't know if they have a Tesla as an option and they have another car, and if their cars are similar to price, then they prefer the Tesla over the other car. What we are doing is, so for example, Model 3 standard range for us costs, it's like 19 cents a minute, 7.9 euros an hour, 39 euros a day. And then we charge like 29 cents per kilometer as well, which is a little bit less than, let's say, our biggest competitors like Audi A4, for example. So it's, yeah, like, no, it's not very expensively priced. It's completely like reasonable, essentially. And then the advantage, of course, for us is that like right now, if you, for example, look at the utilization of our cars relative to other providers, we see that like we are, on average, like we are around 40% and the market is around 25%. So relatively, we are doing like 60% better than the market. We kind of achieved that by having a kind of low pricing, given that, you know, the car itself costs actually 30% more, maybe like than a competitor's car. But, we make it up kind of with utilization, because every kilometer driven on our car is way cheaper than a kilometer driven on an ICE vehicle, just because of the fuel expense.
When you think about the demand side, there's a base assumptions that we work under. There's no loyalty, more or less. We love the one or two, you know, super fans, super promoters, basically, but usually no loyalty. It's all about price and locations. And then your strategy is, and if they are about the same, then people prefer the premium car. And so you are in a mature car sharing market. You mentioned 600,000 people, several thousand car sharing cars, six providers. Most of the time, probably users have this availability of maybe multiple offerings. And then you go in with a relatively low pricing to drive up the utilization and earn the money back despite the low pricing through utilization, because your cost per driven kilometer is relatively low.
I should maybe add here that like the pricing is like relatively low compared to other premium cars, but nevertheless, you know, if you look at kind of let's say there's 2,000 car sharing cars, you know, most of them like 1.8k, 1.7k are gonna be very, very, let's say, like low end cars, like Toyota Yaris's, Hyundai i20s, you know, cars that cost like significantly less than Tesla. And then, of course, there's a segment for kind of, let's say, more premium cars, which is what we operate in. And then we are priced, you know, in that segment, we are, let's say, on the low end for the cheapest Model 3 standard range. And then for the Model Y long range, of course, we are on the higher end.
And you launched with minute-based free floating, like we most think of when we say car sharing, but you're also extending into the hourly rentals, daily rentals, even subscription models already by now. How did that come about? Do you see that as a big part of your future, or is that more an experiment at the moment?
We launched subscription mid-December last year, so a month and a half ago. Of course, like basically, it's just like demand, right? Like it's something that people were asking for. We could see very clearly that car sharing, let's say free-floating car sharing, is great if you just need the car for, you know, let's say very occasionally. So I don't know, once or twice a month, or if you are a daily driver, but your drives are relatively short. And if you don't have kids, you don't have dogs, you don't need to, like, your car isn't, let's say, like your extension of your house, essentially. But there's very many people still that need car for longer for one reason or another. Either they need to drive a lot and they need to make sure that they always have the car next to them. Maybe they have a kid, they need to keep their kid's chair in the car, and it's you know, the booster seats in car sharing maybe are not kind of good enough. You need like an actual one, or you don't want to risk having to chase a car down the street when you have a two-year-old, you know, at your hand. So kind of all these different reasons, people might need a car for longer than, you know, a day or a few days at different stages of their life. But it doesn't mean that they want to buy a car for 5 years, take the financial commitment, have to deal with all the maintenances, insurances, all that kind of things. So we naturally, you know, subscription became like a topic for us because people were asking for that. And, you know, once again, because we have this, especially in this market, kind of unique advantage in terms of being able to buy Teslas for very good prices, but also like maintain them and insure them and all these things, we are able to offer extremely competitive prices to our customers for a subscription while still, you know, being very competitive with anything else that's on the market, but on the bottom line, of course, making much larger margins for subscription cars than anybody else does. So yeah, we launched that. The take rate has been super good. And of course, it's very cool for us because the we basically have zero customer acquisition cost with subscription. We have, you know, there's like 45,000 users that have signed up on Oxdrive. Most of them that we see that like most of the people that come for subscription have already been using car sharing. So they know Oxdrive, they know the brand, they know the cars, they trust us. So it's just a extra button click for them that like, hey, now I want to take a car for a month. Now I want to take a car for 6 months. And they just do that and we deliver the car and they can have it. They can return it whenever, you know, they don't need the car anymore, but they don't need to like worry about what happens if, you know, something goes wrong with the car. We just had a case, for example, a month ago where one of the heat pumps on a Model Y failed for a subscription client. Like normally he would have to figure out, okay, how do I take this car to Tesla, booking service time, all these things. With our subscription, it was just like, okay, you have an issue with the car. We'll come bring you another car. We'll leave it with you. We'll take back the damaged car. We'll take care of it with the Tesla. And that's it for him. Like that's his whole experience. And he just pays the monthly payment, right? So it's pretty wonderful.
Incredible user experience. Do you see the synergies between minute-based car sharing or these different sharing models up to subscription as so strong that it doesn't make sense to run only one of them in isolation?
Yeah, I mean, they're basically like, you know, different versions of the same thing, right? Like a person that needs a car for driving from, I don't know, point A to point B, or he needs a car for, you know, different reasons. Because your car is not only, you know, bringing you from point A to point B, it's also oftentimes an extension of your kind of house where you keep your stuff, you know, especially if you have kids. So there are different reasons why people need the car and how they need the car. So I don't really like see them as a, competing product offerings. It's just like serving different kind of customer needs at different times of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Do you differentiate these different use cases like with different product names, at least like internally? Like for example, to say, okay, this is sharing is minute based up to a day, and then rental is at least 1 day, and a subscription is at least 1 month, something like that? Or how do you talk about this?
So we do, we say sharing is, or car sharing is up to 1 month, and then everything above that goes into subscription.
Right.
So I was saying that, like, we see, for example, with our car sharing users, that the ones that use the car super often, or not that they use it very often, but they use it for long rentals, then we actually proactively offer them that, like, hey, it might make more financial sense for you to switch to a subscription, because the monthly payment kind of ends up being less than in car sharing a little bit. But you don't then get things like, for example, charging card included with the car, so you have to pay for your own electricity.
You told me before that you are working on financial plans at the moment, updating everything. It's time for the next funding round. You have some interested investors. They want to kind of challenge you on your assumptions, probably, to really provide some term sheets. What are you projecting roughly, if you want to share this, in a year, 2 years in the future? What percentage of your business will be more the sharing part versus the subscription part? Actually, is that mainly subscription, and then sharing is kind of a way to acquire customers into that, or is subscription still a minority?
I think subscription will always be a minority, but it's a kind of a very meaningful minority. So, for example, what we see right now is that we have 150 cars, and in the last month, you know, we brought 30 cars into subscription, I think, today.
Wow.
So the take rate has been, like, very, very high. And, like, we also see, for example, that for subscription, the biggest demand is for Model Ys. And we are, like, struggling with adding new cars into car sharing into Model Y, which we want to do, is because, like, every one we buy goes into subscription. So we're just kind of trying to buy as many Model Ys as we can.
Presumably, it's not the easiest time to raise equity for car sharing at the moment. It's not super new anymore. Some expectations have not played out in the last years overall, and other providers, some strategics went out of it again and so on. But what's your hook when you talk about your own business also to investors now? Like, what are they maybe missing, or what's different for you? What's most exciting for you that you would share with investors?
We have extremely strong fundamentals. So we're basically profitable already just at 150 cars on a kind of car level. So every car we add into our fleet earns us profit. And so that's kind of, we're extremely efficient with our operations on the kind of one side. And then on the other end, we have very, very high utilization or very high demand because of a very attractive product for the customers. So we kind of put these two things together, and the business and the numbers are looking really good.
What's the fleet size that you think is realistic that you could be having roughly, like, order of magnitude in 2 years?
Yeah, so what we're going to do next is we're currently Riga, but, you know, we have the three Baltic markets, so Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. And kind of from the outside, it's basically, you could treat them as one market, effectively. So we're going to expand to Tallinn and Vilnius in the next upcoming months, and our aim is to grow to 850 approximately cars in the next 12 months. We think it's, like, super doable. Like, you know, when we were starting out, getting debt was hard. Now we kind of, it's slipping a little bit. We already have, you know, been able to kind of secure debt. And we also see, like, you know, other banks kind of starting to be interested in, like, financing us, and kind of one thing follows the other. So, you know, debt is not that that hard anymore for us. Now it's, we need to kind of do a meaningful equity round. And yeah, we'll do 850 cars. It will bring us to pretty nice kind of revenue numbers. Like, we're looking at probably 10 million annually. And we will have the whole Baltic markets market covered. And then we can quite nicely, I think, like, start looking at expanding to bigger markets.
And on the way there, assuming the funding is now secured, path to 850 cars, 10 million revenue, what's the thing that you think maybe you still mostly have to figure out? Like, some things are already super clear, you know now how they work, but what's, like, the most challenging part for you still at this point?
I think, you know, besides, like, buying cars, but I think that, you know, getting the cars is not a challenge for us anymore. It's more, you know, figuring out the back-end operations even, like, more efficiently. So we're extremely efficient already today, but there's still, like, a lot of things that can be automated, developed, kind of made nice. It's very interesting how we are already today using, you know, ChatGPT, like, kind of large language models for, I don't know, we're processing all of our speeding and parking fines that we get from this local road administration with ChatGPT today. And it's cutting down a task that used to take something like 6 to 7 hours per week. It now only takes, like, 1 hour per week for a person to do it, but it can actually, like, be fully automated. So building these kind of, let's say, software automations and the AI component is very interesting for us. And then, you know, other things, like, so that we're not just throwing, like, people at the problem, but we're kind of being smart about kind of solving problems. So also, you know, as you expand to new markets, the fleet operations in these markets as well, like, it's probably going to be a little bit different than it is in Riga. Although we have, again, like, you know, figured it out pretty well in Riga, how we, you know, charge our cars, clean our cars, relocate our cars to the demand areas. So so kind of doing all of these kind of operational things. But other than that, I think we have a pretty good idea kind of how to do this. And maybe like one more like that's going to be really exciting is the ability that we don't need to finance all of our cars and ourselves anymore because of this strong brand and kind of local presence that we have built. We have dealerships and other car brands that actually want to work with us because apparently we are a great customer acquisition channel for them. So if there's a new Audi e-tron that's in Austria, it gets 4, 5, 6 rentals per day or rides per day, and some of these people might turn into a buyer for the dealer, right? Or we might help sell these cars as well if needed. So we're expecting to actually essentially expand our fleet quite significantly without actually having to lock up our own money anymore, which is really cool.
Sounds really cool, really promising, really exciting. And you are always, despite like all this brand that you have built and like the fun factor in the cars that you're using and so on, you're always keeping your eyes, it sounds like, on the pricing, main challenge after funding is secured, operational efficiency. How can we do things smarter, internal tooling? You've had great experience. You want to push this even further, leveraging AI within that. Because in the end of the day, it's all like price and location. And then people choose. They're so much not loyal and just using the best deal. And you can provide it against your competitors.
Yeah, I mean, like in the end of the day, like if you want people to drive electric or drive sustainably, but also like maybe give up their own personal car, you really need to make it like a no-brainer. Right. So like there should be like no incentive for you to buy a car if you can use car sharing and if it's a convenient way of using car sharing, meaning that you know that the car is going to be there when I need it. The car is going to be clean. All is good and the pricing kind of makes sense. So in order to do all of those things, you really need to like all the time fight to push down the underlying costs that go into the operation or the kind of owning the car or like giving out that car to the person and, making sure that you deliver a great service. So figuring these things out is kind of very, very important. And then you have a good adoption and taking us closer to the sustainable kind of future as well at the same time. So
make it a no-brainer if you want to take the consumers along on both convenience pricing. I think we saw a lot of operators also exiting the market in the last years, and you are kind of swimming in the opposite direction. One of like a smaller group of people who are doing that and successfully already like breaking some records in a way, despite the early stages after only a year and a half and with still a relatively small fleet, but that also allows you to learn and optimize things along the way and then not have to kind of get out of the business so quickly again, like some bigger rental companies are now doing at the moment, have huge step entry, these huge step out again. And you are like really perfecting this along the way. Super impressive. And yeah, thank you. You are super busy. You told us it's been also a rough kind of year and a half and even the last few days now, some late nights, and still taking this time out of your day is super nice to share with everyone else who might sometimes feel like maybe there's not so much to gain here anymore. And you're like providing an example where can be super exciting if you're executing well. I think your previous experience might only help you.
Yeah, I think like we are still like so early into this market, right? Like 90, I just checked the data, like 98% of the cars in the world are still like ICE vehicles. Mm-hmm. And totally. Basically 99% of them are like privately owned, but they're like being used by one person, one car. We want to have one car and many people using that car and getting the same level of experience as if they own that car. So we have a super long way to go. We're just getting started.
Even I would say like a better experience in the example that you provided, right? Like I have this problem in my car now. Where can you get a substitute still on the same day and continue? It's even better than before.
Yeah. Another interesting thing is like we're like, for example, working with local insurance companies now, like where if something happens to one of their clients' cars, they take a Tesla from us. And this kind of also like works like a customer acquisition channel for us, where we've seen that people, that had their own car fixed, would come back to us or like use our car sharing like afterwards or take a car for rental from us. Or I think one guy is even like wants to buy a car from us or take it into subscription or something like that. So yeah, that's pretty cool.
Very much startup mode, kind of seeing opportunity everywhere and like quickly executing on them. Cool. Thanks a lot, Johan, for all your transparency and openness today and for taking the time. It was fun to talk to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Happy to talk to you always.
Bye-bye.